Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, local newspapers are dying out. We take a look at the ramifications, plus the audio diaries of a nurse working long shifts during COVID. But first, the return to outdoor dining has been welcome news for local businesses this week. But as FM89's Sarith Hawk tells us, it won't be enough to make up for losses. She visits one iconic Madeira restaurant to see just how essential workers are coping.
It's just before the 5 o'clock dinner hour, and tickets are starting to print out in the Vineyard's kitchen. Customer Robert Fisher walks in to pick up his dinner order.
Oh, we've got the special tonight. We've got the calzone, so I can't wait to get home to dig into that.
He gets takeout a couple of times a week to support Madeira restaurants. He's been coming to the Vineyard for 15 years and says he wants to make sure it stays.
This is a place of gathering for a lot of people here in Madeira. And you come to see people, you come to meet people, you run into people, no matter what.
Owner Chris Mariscotti's family opened the bar and restaurant 43 years ago. Inside, the lights are dimmed and the dining room is empty.
We can seat 120 people and it's pretty lonely here right now, isn't it?
Mariscotti says since December, the restaurant has been doing about 20% of normal business. And now he's making a plan to adjust to outdoor dining once again after Governor Newsom lifted the stay-at-home order Monday. But Mariscotti says he's still catching up to staffing challenges.
Normal operation, we were at 33, 34 people. I think we have 14 people working now, and most of them are working 2 days a week.
Essential workers have taken on huge job losses during the pandemic, including here at the Vineyard. Those still working have had to make sacrifices or find other means of making a living.
Lamb shanks, lasagna, maple fried chicken, and a pork loin.
Lead line cook Cody Herring is moving steadily from the fryer to the grill and sauté station. He's lucky to be one of two people at the restaurant getting more hours.
At the beginning of this, I was just kind of another hand in the kitchen, and I've had to take a lot more responsibility over the last few months.
That's true of his professional and personal life. Herring and his wife recently had their first baby. He says things got really bad when all three contracted COVID-19 in December.
But it was a very terrifying time being a new parent, having a global pandemic, the disease, in your home with your new child. It was terrifying.
All three are fully recovered now and their symptoms were not severe. But Herring says one of the biggest challenges was losing out on a month of income.
All the rigors of being a new parent on top of that and not bringing an income in and paying bills, it is a struggle, and I know there's a lot of people going out there going through it.
At the kitchen's baking station, pastry chef and cook Savannah Ochoa is making cheesecake batter.
I add a little bit of extra sour cream because it gives it a nice rise. And the flavor too, yeah.
She dealt with a cut in hours by starting her own business on the side. Ochoa says a few coworkers pushed her to start it.
It's called Baking While Baked. And it's only social media platform, so I only have Instagram right now.
She makes everything from cheesecakes to cookies and cakes. She says the name of her business attracted some attention.
I chose Baking While Baked because I get stoned while I baked, and it inspires me to be a little bit more creative.
She emphasized it's just her, not the food, unless a customer makes a request. Already, business has been picking up.
I have quite a few clientele, a lot of regulars. I have over 1,000 followers on Instagram already.
On her days off from the restaurant, she bakes at home, fulfilling orders. Chris Mariscotti says his loyal staff is one of the reasons why he's been able to stay open. He points out other advantages for his business. His family owns the building, so they don't have a rent payment to meet. And he credits the strong personal relationships he and his staff have built within the community.
So that gives us some advantage, but that doesn't make us bulletproof. I mean, at some point, we can't do that forever.
He just hopes the pandemic won't change people's habits for good, and that old friends in the community will return to the vineyard. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Governor Gavin Newsom has made bold promises to solve homelessness, and thousands of people have been sheltered under his watch. But as Chris Nichols, our colleague at CAP Radio, explains, advocates wonder if the early success will last.
Past California governors largely ignored the state's homelessness crisis. Newsom has tried to tackle the problem head on.
I don't think homelessness can be solved. I know that homelessness can be solved.
Newsom devoted nearly all of last year's State of the State address to this ongoing human emergency.
This is our cause. It's our calling. Let's all rise to the challenge and make California stand up as an exemplar of what true courage and compassion can achieve. Let's all get to work. Thank you, guys. Thank y'all.
In some ways, he has delivered. Newsom has worked with state lawmakers to invest billions of dollars in housing, rental assistance, and health services for homeless people. Last year, his team searched the state for excess land and even vacant hospitals to use as shelters. This spring, he won praise for moving more than 22,000 homeless people into motel rooms, all to prevent major outbreaks of COVID-19. The effort, called Project Roomkey, largely worked.
Being inside, it means a lot to me. It does. I feel safe. I'm safe. I'm secure.
That's 65-year-old Curtis Freeman, who was on the streets of Sacramento for nearly a year. He lived in a tent under a freeway, often afraid for his life. Then in March, he got a motel room through Roomkey. Standing outside his motel near Interstate 5, wearing a black and white beanie, Freeman says he's no longer afraid.
I ain't got to worry about nobody, you know, coming in. I can lay down and relax.
But despite Newsom's efforts, the crisis remains. Homeless camps line sidewalks, riverbanks, and freeways across the state. An estimated 150,000 Californians are without a home, according to the most recent federal survey. This summer, to build on the progress of Roomkey, Newsom introduced Project Homekey. The new effort awarded $800 million to cities and counties to buy motels for more permanent homeless housing. But some of Newsom's critics say without providing more services, programs like Roomkey and Homekey just serve to score political points.
That results in leaders patting themselves on the back and checking another box.
Former state lawmaker Mike Gatto, a Democrat from Los Angeles, says Newsom's policies need to have a greater emphasis on mental health treatment so that people are more self-sufficient.
But in reality, the people are not given the support that they need or, frankly, the tough love that they need. And then they wind out back on the street.
Newsom says mental health support is on its way as part of the nearly $2 billion he wants to spend on homelessness in his January budget. Jennifer Friedenbach of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco says Newsom deserves credit for his early actions as governor, but she and others who work with the unhoused say the state needs a permanent source of funding to fight the problem.
I would give him good marks for focusing on homelessness, but he's really tinkering around the edges and needs to go much farther. You know, bring in additional revenue in order to address the situation at the scale that the crisis calls for.
Friedenbach, who has known Newsom since his time in local government in San Francisco, says he's always had bold ideas. She says the question now is whether he can follow through and truly solve this growing crisis. In Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As the pandemic rages on, healthcare workers continue to feel overwhelmed. Erin McIntosh is a nurse at Riverside Community Hospital. Throughout the recent surge in COVID cases, she's recorded a series of audio diaries after long shifts taking care of the sick and dying. Today, we bring you a compilation of those diaries.
My name's Erin. I'm a rapid response nurse, and I'm here with your mother or father or sister. And I just want you to know that I'm here with them and they're not alone, and I'm holding their hand. We're going to do everything that we possibly can to take care of them. Rapid response overhead. I know it's time. Gotta run quickly, gotta get there in time. Gotta save this patient. As soon as I walk to the door, I can see it from across the room. The patient's breathing very fast. Normally, someone breathes about 12 to 20 breaths per minute, nice and slow. But these patients are gasping for air, using all of their muscles, just about 60 times. There's a look on the face of this woman, sheer fright. She knows it's coming. I can tell she's afraid. I take the time, put on my gear, go in the room, and I grab her hand. The first thing I do is get right at eye level. My name is Erin. I'm here for you. I'm just a nurse, and I'm going to take care of you. Do you feel me holding your hand? Can you hear me talking to you? She looks at me and shakes her head, still breathing fast. She's on the BiPAP machine, full support. It's pushing air into her face, so it's hard for her to talk. I say in a calming, soothing voice as best as I can, listen to me talking to you. Close your eyes. All I want you to do is focus on breathing. Slow. Slow down your breathing. In through your nose and out through your mouth. Just like you're blowing out a candle. Nice and slow. There you go. You got this. She's still looking at me like she's so afraid. I can tell the tears are starting to come out now. It's too late. We have to intubate her. But I already know how that ends. First thing we have to do, we have to call family. I look to the nurse. Do you have the phone number for the family? No, I didn't get the phone number. She was fine earlier. She was fine. I look at the patient. Do you have a cell phone? And she gestures to me. Yeah, over there, pointing at the bedside table. I can see her phone. So I grab it really quickly. It's got some kind of lock. How frustrating. Okay, use your fingers and unlock your phone so we can call your family. I can hear her saying, my daughter. It's muffled, but I know that's what she's saying. So I whisper to her, you want me to call your daughter? And she shakes her head yes. She can't tell me the code. She can't even speak. She's fumbling. It's like she can't see. She's starting to lose consciousness. Hurry, please tell me the code so we can call your daughter. We have to call your daughter. She's in her 60s, maybe 70s. She's older. I don't think she'll make it. She's fumbling with the phone. It's not the right code. That's not it, honey. Let's try again. Slow down your breathing. Nice and slow. In through your nose, out through your mouth. She's more afraid now. And now her vital signs are dropping. I gotta do two things at once. Call the RT. Get the doctor here. We've gotta intubate. Quickly. Get the RSI. Get the meds. I'm trying to fumble with her phone. I have people bringing in meds, bringing in stuff, and her phone gets locked. It's too late. We don't have a number for the family. We have to intubate her. We didn't even get a hold of her daughter. I just hold her hand. I'm right here with you. I'll take care of you. You're going to be comfortable in just a moment. We're going to give you some meds. We're going to make you comfortable. We're going to take such great care of you. Being at work is very chaotic. You know, patients very sick, dealing with suffering and dying. And then I transition to home. I have four little kids that are excited to see me. And they just want to spend time with their mom. In the early months, I lived in a hotel for almost 2 months because I was afraid to bring it home to them. And even still, I do have a ritual of, you know, right when I get home, I take off my shoes outside and I have to hurry up and clean everything, throw my clothes directly into the washer and take a shower. I have two little young ones, a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old, who don't understand. And they come running at the door. I love you, mommy. I love you. And they want to give me a hug. And I almost have to fight them off. Sometimes I'll have my two older ones take them upstairs so they don't see me, because that makes it a little easier. I always think about this one patient, Maria. She was the same age as me and had three kids. She got coronavirus on Thanksgiving. She got together with her family on Thanksgiving. She was starting to do worse, and I had to transfer her to the ICU, and I brought her there, and she was just crying hysterically. I had to try to slow down her crying. Listen to me, Maria, listen. You have to slow down your breathing. You can't keep crying like that. Wailing, crying, just, I want to go home. I want to see my babies. But if she didn't stop, her heart was going to stop. That's how low her oxygen was doing. So I just sat there and held her hand. Listen to me, Maria. Listen to my voice. Please stop crying. Please. She didn't make it. I keep thinking about that. Those three little kids. They won't have their mom come home. So yeah, it sucks that my kids have to deal with me having to go through so much. And maybe at times I'm not fully present. But I feel luckier than Maria. The happy moments are hard to come by in the hospital anymore these days. I guess I would have to say the happy moment I'm having is that our numbers are not going up. They're no longer 250 COVID positive in our hospital. We've kind of hovered around 220. Now, unfortunately, part of that number is the fact that many are dying. But that's a good thing that we're not increasing like they told us they would. It gives me hope that maybe the worst is behind us.
That was Riverside Community Hospital nurse Erin McIntosh. Thanks to our colleagues at KCRW in LA who produced her story. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When a local newspaper is forced to reduce its reporting staff or shut down altogether, research shows there's a dramatic impact on the community it serves. Often voter participation goes down, while government borrowing goes up. To find out more about the connection between local newspapers and the democratic process, I spoke with Paul Myers, editor of the Sun-Gazette newspaper in Tulare County, Dipna Uguoju, editor of the Fresnoland Lab at the Fresno Bee, Jonathan Metas-Stein, executive director at California Common Cause, and Nora Benavides, director of U.S. Free Expression Programs with PEN America. Benavides started the conversation by explaining how local papers went from earning huge profit margins to where they are today.
To understand what's happening with local news, we need to understand both the market failures that we've seen over the last 15 years, as well as then other issues like media consolidation. You know, local journalism, I would say, has reached a point of market failure, just point blank. And part of what PEN America has been doing over the last several years is studying that issue and sort of the phenomenon where, with the rise of the internet and this digital age, we've seen a shift in the primary source of ad revenue, which had been helping to sustain local journalism. Of course, with plummeting revenue, local journalism has suffered in a number of ways. Meanwhile, so many papers, stations, TV, radio are being bought and consolidated into media conglomerates. Often that can bring with it often relentless cost cutting. And so there's a lot of different converging issues that over the last 15 years has created a kind of perfect storm. Even the COVID pandemic has helped amplify the issues that local journalists are suffering from, the kind of decline in further ad revenue for local papers. So we're really in this crisis moment where I think a lot of the local people we work with at PEN America have seen this as a flashpoint where We need to be thinking about how political polarization has helped open up space for disinformation to thrive where local journalists weren't before. And it's an issue that, of course, has been occupying so much of our advocacy and our conversation around the country.
Jonathan, maybe you could elaborate on that and speak more to what the impact is to a community when they lose their local newspaper.
First, let me just put some numbers to the collapse of local journalism. Between 2004 and 2019, about 2,100 newspapers shut down their presses for good across the United States. In California, over that time period, we've lost about 25% of our local newspapers. And the newspapers that survive are shells of their former selves in many respects. In the last 10 years or so, we've lost about 50% of newsroom employment in the United States. So when we have fewer papers and we have papers that are less able to cover their local communities, there are all sorts of difficult, problematic impacts on our democracy. So newspapers play a critical role in educating and engaging local electorates. Evidence shows that when newspapers close, it leads to decreased civic participation, it leads to less informed voting, and it leads to lower voter turnout. It also means that we lose the most critical watchdog in our communities that hold government accountable and hold corporations and industry accountable. There's data that shows that when local press coverage decreases, more incumbents go unchallenged in elections, the winning candidate's margin of victory grows, local borrowing costs by local governments go up, suggesting that newspaper coverage has an impact on good city financial management. And there's even evidence that shows that pollution goes up when an industry or a local business is no longer covered by a local paper. So there's really strong evidence that shows that we are losing the core of our local democracies when we lose our newspapers.
Dipna Ugoju, you're the editor of the Fresno Land Lab at the Fresno Bee, and I know that this is something that you have spent a lot of time thinking about. Can you just weigh in on this topic and maybe tell us a little bit about how the Fresno Bee in particular is sort of thinking outside of the box in order to fill those gaps in coverage?
After I joined the Bee, and Fresno Land had a grant, and the purpose of the grant was to address the news deserts, all these areas that are no longer covered. Because a few years ago, the Bee was able to have news bureaus in other parts of the valley, for example, in Visalia, also in foothills, etc. But all those disappeared with the budget cuts, and even the newsroom at the Bee has a handful of reporters trying to cover everything. So one of the things that we did was to try to adopt a program that's going on in other parts of the country. It's called the Documenters. The first one was started in Chicago, and then they have it in Dayton, Ohio. They have it in Cleveland, and I believe in Detroit. We are the fourth in line. And what basically we have done with it is to realize that, and this is our purpose. In your city, in your town, there are dozens, maybe even hundreds of meetings that take place in your local government every month. And they deal with important things that impact our lives on a daily basis. And they have these meetings that are not even known to the public. Meanwhile, they're making choices that impact us. Because they're not watched by the media, they don't have to follow any of the rules. They can make decisions. They can post them. They can write minutes. They can choose not to write minutes. And even when they write minutes, these information are very difficult to find. And sometimes they're not even updated regularly. For example, we found that when the pandemic started and we had the stay-at-home orders, meetings continued with most local governments and agencies. Yet, not all of them try to create access to people who would like to participate in these meetings from their homes, but a handful of them did. So with the Documenters program, we train people, it was open to the public, people applied, we selected them, we trained them, teaching them basic news writing, basic note-taking, also about the laws and ethics, so they can go and cover these meetings. And so that we collect and standardize all the information that they gather so that they can be accessible to anyone. And meanwhile, the other reporters at the Bee can use the information gathered in these meetings for their own news stories. And it's a very little way, but at least we are making an effort to see that more of these rural areas and agencies are covered, especially in these pandemic times.
And just to clarify, this program is financed through a grant, is that correct?
Yes, it is financed through a grant. And what we found as we go back for more grant funding is that many of the funders are really very interested in this, because one of the things that it does also, it encourages media literacy, even among the people collecting the news, and also it engages the community in ways that they had probably never been engaged before.
So I do want to come back to this idea of philanthropy, but first I want to bring in Paul Myers. Paul, you're the editor of the Sun Gazette newspaper in Tulare County, which is also a part of the state that is covered by the Visalia Times Delta. Can you just explain for our listeners how the Sun Gazette differs in the coverage and the focus of its work?
As far as the difference between us and the Visalia Times Delta, from a structural point of view, we're a weekly newspaper and they're a daily newspaper. But as far as the actual coverage goes, I do feel that we're a little bit more conscientious about what it is that we choose to cover and versus what the Visalia Times Delta chooses to cover. We really do our best to cover the in-depth topics of local government that we hope enriches the lives of our readers, instead of necessarily covering what we see on Facebook that's gathering a lot of traction. So we do pride ourselves on that quite a bit. And without being a corporate newspaper and having the top-down struggles that comes with that, we're independently owned. Our publisher works on the other side of this wall, as a matter of fact. So I do get direct access to what I think is necessarily best for the coverage, regardless of whatever traction it might get. And we don't really have these goals or benchmarks to reach over traffic online or how many subscribers we're trying to get that day either. So I think that as far as the difference goes, I think it's probably sits in the freedom that we get as an independent paper versus some of the struggles with autonomy that a corporate newspaper has.
I know that you have used philanthropy to help expand your coverage. Talk a little bit about that, Paul.
We were fortunate enough to receive a grant from a Report for America, who's doing excellent work throughout the country on helping small newsrooms fund at least one reporter on a particular beat. So for us, we got a young reporter coming just out of college in Missouri, and we identified that we needed more coverage in Tulare County on agriculture. So she came to us, Caitlin Washburn, and with the hopes of digging into the ag sector, since it affects everybody in Tulare County and throughout the valley, you could really make the argument for. I would say, as far as the stories that came out of it, I think what we learned is exactly how in-depth ag actually is ingrained into our lives. So some of the stories that she did were about like food insecurity and food supplements to help with food banks. And what we kind of realized and what we were hoping to get out of this position was getting a little bit more investigative. But what we learned was that ag, as far as an industry goes, a lot of folks don't like to talk about the industry. And so, unfortunately, this grant's only a year long. And really what we would have required is at least 2 years of somebody really hitting that beat as hard as they could before they actually started to crack through. Because the stories that she did, honestly, I probably could have done given enough time. So, you know, while we didn't really get exactly what we wanted out of that grant and out of that position and out of that beat, I think what we did learn was also valuable with how difficult of a beat it is to cover.
Nora Benavides, you are the director of U.S. Free Expression Programs with PEN America and have researched the importance of local newspapers in the past. Can you just speak to the value of the kind of reporting that is done, you know, by papers like the Sun Gazette in these communities, and why TV and radio and online reporting just doesn't quite replace what is lost when small independent papers go down?
That's such a great question. And I think that part of that question has to also address what I think is the flip side of so much of community distrust now around the news industry. And unfortunately, that has sort of calcified how the public and how community members come to or think about the value of journalism. But local papers serve such a critical role in communities. They are many times the kind of mouthpiece for issues that are overlooked by mainstream and national outlets, issues that may not crop up or be made aware of in larger regional circles. And so it's the one-on-one dynamics between people in communities, the reporters that know the long-time pastor in a certain community who knows another individual who has a long history of understanding different local history. And that is the kind of dynamic that when you lose a local paper, you lose all of the institutional knowledge, you lose all of the relational ability that that paper had to investigate things, to both shine a light on what might otherwise go unreported on, but also then to sort of be that cornerstone of democracy that I know Jonathan touched on. Because, you know, democracy sounds like such an abstract concept, and I absolutely agree. It's like, what does that look like in practice? But your local paper can be the reason that you understand when you can go vote. It may be the reason that someone starts reporting on or investigating why a certain government official's salary has gone up. Meanwhile, local community members are suffering from, you know, X, Y, and Z issues. And so the really kind of granular ways that democracy actually meets the road, if you will, like the rubber meets the road, that's the stuff that local journalism can mean the difference between people engaging and feeling engaged with each other and otherwise feeling disconnected, alienated, that somehow there isn't anyone local to them touching on the issues that mean something to them.
This is Paul. Can I jump in?
Absolutely.
On that point? So I really like what Nora has to say a lot, because I think it hits on the relationship factor that used to exist between newspapers and the community. And I think through our experience with Report for America, one of the things that was missing was these sources and the source development that I think used to be there with other newspapers in the area, like the Fresno Bee, for example, who doesn't necessarily do a lot of coverage in Tulare County anymore, but also the Visalia Times Delta, who's had their staff cut time and time and time again. And those are the things that we're missing. We are missing these sources and this source development that was crucial to this relationship between the newspaper and its community.
That's such an important point. Thank you so much for that. You know, when I think about what is happening from an economic perspective to journalism, to the profession as a whole, it seems to me that the solution is really simple. People just need to pay for content. The problem is nobody wants to pay for content. And because of the former business model, you know, advertising-based business model, they didn't have to pay all that much. And so, you know, as I research this topic, you know, something that comes up a lot is, you know, again, the role of philanthropy and also perhaps the role government should take to support the free press. But of course, that raises all sorts of alarms and concerns as well. Jonathan, can you talk about how the government could maybe step in, or how philanthropy could step in a more meaningful and successful way to fill those gaps?
Definitely. And I think the first thing we have to do is begin conceiving of journalism, particularly at the local and community level, as a public good, the same as roads and clean air and clean water. This is something that serves us in our communities and serves our democracy. And we need to step up as an electorate and as, you know, at the governmental level in order to preserve it. So there are ways that we can begin to revitalize our local and ethnic media sectors without compromising their independence. For example, we could use a government advertising set aside where when state agencies or local agencies have to do outreach, they are required to place their advertising in local and ethnic media. That's been used in New York City, for example, with great success. We could provide tax credits for newspaper subscriptions so that somebody gets a $50 rebate when they subscribe to a new newspaper, or a tax credit for small businesses advertising in their local community newspaper or in local ethnic media. That would act as a subsidy to small business in the era of COVID when it's badly needed, and act as a boost for our local papers. Or if we wanted to get more aggressive, we could require news content aggregators like Facebook and like Google that have hoovered up all of the ad revenue that used to go to the original creators of content and require them to pay a small access fee for using that content, or a digital advertising tax that puts money back in the hands of the original creators of content. In each of those examples, news outlets receive compensation in accordance with their success and in a way that is sort of related to or based on the open market. There's no government entity choosing which outlets get funding and thus survive, and which don't get funding and thus wither on the vine. There are ways we can get creative and innovative. Admittedly, we have to get creative and innovative and think about new solutions that have not really been implemented elsewhere. But if we're willing to do that, I think that we can bring government support to our critically needed news institutions without compromising their independence.
Dipna, what needs to change in journalism in order to regain the trust of the public?
I think it starts at the very local level, building trust with the people that you cover. And that brings up that whole new, since Newbery really isn't, of engagement journalism, where you're writing for your readers, not writing about them necessarily. They have to see that they're gaining something, which is tied to why people are not willing to pay for the news they consume, because they don't see that it directly benefits their lives in the way that other things that they pay for benefit their lives. We must go back to making the news content that we produce change lives, improve lives, inform them, whether it's about the weather and the things in their immediate neighborhoods that could be impacting their lives, about contaminants, about decisions that are made at City Hall or the state level, and how all those things impact their day-to-day activities. They have to be able to measure it and say, yes, it counts. It makes a difference in our lives.
I've been speaking with Dipna Uguoju, editor at the Fresnoland Lab at the Fresno Bee, Paul Myers, editor of the Sun Gazette newspaper in Tulare County, Jonathan Metta-Stein, executive director at California Common Cause, and Nora Benavides, director of U.S. Free Expression Programs with PEN America. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. In a surprise move this week, the Newsom administration lifted COVID-19 shelter-in-place orders, even as our death toll continues to rise at an alarming rate. Here to explain why the change and to tell us about the efforts to vaccinate farm workers is FM89's Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hello. Thanks, Kathleen.
So first, let's begin with a look across the valley.
Right. Well, this week I have a mix of grim milestones as well as some cautious optimism. So, you know, as you mentioned, the shelter-in-place order has been lifted here and in Southern California. You know, that's because the case rates and positivity rates are finally trending in the right direction for the first time in months. That being said, we've still got around 2,000 people testing positive for the virus every single day in the valley. You know, so in Kern County now, you know, bringing that all together, 1 in 10 people have had the virus there. In Kings County, it's 1 in 8. And so many people are still dying of this virus. You know, there are between 200 and 300 deaths that are being reported every week. That is 10 times higher than what we were seeing during the lull just before Thanksgiving. On the other hand, however, I mean, some of the pressure is easing off of hospitals. You know, ICUs still have a lot of COVID patients in them, but more generally, we're on the third week of a downward trend in terms of the number of COVID patients in general medical hospital beds. And so that's good news for everyone. And then, you know, vaccine programs, they continue to chug along here in the valley, but with stops and starts as county health departments grapple with, you know, much smaller and slower supplies than expected.
As you said, some of these trends are going in the right direction, some are not. So why did Governor Newsom lift those shelter-in-place orders now?
Well, that decision, he says, was based on projections of future ICU levels. So the idea is that based on current trends, you know, ICUs in our region will be back up to that 15% more threshold, you know, the 15% or more available beds, you know, around 4 weeks down the road. And so now we're back to the system that we were in before those orders, you know, this so-called blueprint for a safer economy with color-coded guides for business and school reopenings. Almost every county in the state is in purple, the most restrictive tier, but Mariposa is in red, one of the few counties doing better than the rest. And, you know, in a call earlier this week, it's kind of interesting that Fresno County health officials said they didn't expect this change so soon. And so based on that and news reports from around the state, it really seems like Newsom isn't always consulting local leaders before making decisions like this.
Wow. So in most of the Valley, the COVID-19 vaccine is mostly being reserved for healthcare workers and people over 75, or in some counties, 65. But in Fresno County this week, farm workers began receiving the vaccines. How significant is that?
It's certainly a local milestone. I mean, Fresno is the first county in the Valley to vaccinate farm workers. It's among the first in the state. And county supervisors here have been talking about prioritizing this community for a long time. And now they seem to be making good on that promise, at least with some small steps.
And why is this community being prioritized so quickly?
Well, as we've learned throughout this pandemic, it's the folks on the front lines, you know, going to work in person every day who are, you know, being the most exposed to this virus. Statewide, food and ag workers are included in the same tier as educators and emergency services workers. Farm workers here are also overwhelmingly Latino, and Latinos and people of color are contracting the virus and developing severe symptoms at a higher rate than whites. There's also a new study recently out of UC San Francisco that shows California's food and ag workers have suffered the highest mortality rates of any occupation during the pandemic.
So how is Fresno County getting the vaccines to these workers?
Well, so for now, they're setting up a mobile vaccination clinic and sending it out to individual businesses. So there were two events this week that have now administered around 100 vaccines total, and that's out of 3,000 that the county has set aside for farm workers. Our colleague Mari Bolaños was out covering the first event this week at a Mendota cantaloupe producer known as Pappas Family Farms. She spoke with Malesio Medina, who fixes tractors for the company. He mentions a man named George. That's George Pappas, who owns the business.
I mean, it's a great opportunity, man. It's a great opportunity that George is doing this for us. I mean, the people that didn't want it, I mean, I don't know what to tell them, but I mean, it's a great opportunity. There's people out there that were fighting for it. They want it. And I'm just grateful that I got a chance to take it.
Another worker told Mari that his coworkers are wary of side effects of the vaccine, but he knows of workers elsewhere who still need to wait weeks for it, so he jumped at the opportunity. You know, as a system of providing vaccines, the United Farm Workers Union says that even on this small scale, the county is pretty much hitting the mark. Spokesperson Lady Rangel says mobile clinics are essential because so many farm workers lack transportation or have other issues that keep them from other vaccination sites.
What we saw in Fresno, the mobile clinics with the vaccines coming to farm workers and meeting them where they are at, that's exactly what's needed. And we need more of those efforts replicated across the entire United States.
That is a remarkably ringing endorsement from a union that doesn't always see eye to eye with government agencies.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds like it, but that's not to say that this program is perfect. I mean, for one thing, this is rolling out very slowly. I mean, the original plan was to administer 3,000 vaccines by the end of January. Now they're saying it'll take a few weeks. And even then, those will only be first doses. And there are really likely far more than 3,000 farm workers in Fresno County alone. You know, and Fresno County has said this mobile clinic is just one of many models they're trying out with the farm worker community. You know, another is to offer vaccines through rural clinics, you know, places that are likely to serve people on Medi-Cal or without insurance. And, you know, the UFW's Rangel warns that model is just a lot less likely to work.
If we're talking about farm workers who live in rural areas, it might take them 30 minutes just to get to the nearest vaccination location. If they make an appointment with the public health sites, what that means, what that translates to is they're going to have to lose a whole day of work just to get the vaccine.
As you said earlier, this first phase of the program includes 3,000 vaccines being administered over the next few weeks. Why not more and why not faster?
Well, you know, like I said earlier, there's a supply problem, which is plaguing most counties. It's also keeping Fresno's biggest clinic at the fairgrounds closed to new appointments for the second week running now. Beyond that, though, the county is saying they're still figuring out the best way to run these farm worker clinics. Here's Joe Prado. He's the Community Health Division Manager with Fresno County.
As we continue to work towards the planning and really solidify these, we're just learning a lot. Even the one we did in Mendota yesterday, just learning about the registration, how to communicate the health education piece. And as we work throughout all of our food and ag partners as part of this initiative, we'll be able to tell the story to the other food and ag business partners on what the do's and don'ts are of like hosting your own clinic on the job and what that actually looked like. And they can hear the stories from their partners.
Well, Carrie, as always, thank you so much for this reporting.
You're welcome.
And now it's time for StoryCorps San Joaquin, edited conversations from the Mobile 2020 tour in Fresno and Bakersfield, documenting the stories of Valley residents. Today, Fresnan Jeff Bowman tells StoryCorps facilitator Ava Ahmedbegi about childhood summers spent with his pioneering grandmother, Billy Murphy. At age 46, she became the first woman to operate a fire lookout tower in California, 8,000 feet up in the San Bernardino Forest. That was shortly after World War II, and she did it for the next 23 years.
I just had this extraordinary connection with my grandmother, and she ended up taking care of me in the summer a lot because my mom was ill. Mm. So I live with her in the this little tower. It's 14 by 14. I went back to visit, and the guy that was, there was a volunteer, it's a national monument now. Mm-hmm. And he goes, let me get this straight. You were seven, and she did this job and took care of you? And I go, yeah. And he goes, that's impossible. This is what my dad would say. You're going to spend some time with your Grandma Murphy. I want you to pay attention because she's the last pioneer. She occasionally had to kill a rattlesnake around the lookout to keep it safe. People would visit, and I think for her own safety. And she had a board up on the wall that had these rattles. So in my mind, you know, I'd watch all these Westerns, and when I went to visit her, I had a pellet rifle, and my big hope was that I'd kill, mm-hmm. I'd bag a rattlesnake also. I'd kill a rattlesnake. So as luck would have it, in about the last week that I was there, I went to the outhouse, and I was coming back, and I heard a rattle, and I called for Grandma, and she came down. She had a shotgun. 410. They're small, what they call small bore, because she's so tiny. She said the recoil on a regular shotgun would have knocked her over. Mm. But she kept the shotgun for, well, she was living by herself.
Yeah.
And so the rattlesnake had coiled up and was against a boulder, a rock. And she goes, you know, if you want to shoot it, go ahead. So I'll never forget this. I shot the snake, and I was a pretty good marksman for a little guy, and I saw the pellet pierce the skin of the snake, and I got sick. Mm. I threw up. So I'd always thought of this phrase, cowboys always stuck to their guns. And I was standing there, and she goes, well, you're a good shot. And I go, yeah, I got sick. And she goes, yeah, I forgot I had made chicken for lunch. You know, she goes, it's okay. And I go, but I didn't stick to my guns. And she said, I don't think you understand what that means. She goes, if you stick to your beliefs, if you, when it's tough, that's sticking to your guns. She goes, most people that carried a gun in the West never used them at all. She goes, that's a bunch of hooey. She goes, I kill the snakes and save the rattles to honor them. They're souls. She goes, I don't want to kill the snakes, but I have to. She goes, sometimes you do things you have to, but she goes, you're a good guy. She goes, that counts more than anything. And she goes, when the time comes, you stick to your guns. But it has nothing to do with shooting a firearm.
Wow.
And a lightning storm hit while I was there. And it's the scariest. It'd be like being in this room and you're seeing the lightning strike right outside. I don't know if you've ever been in a light. And so you hear this impossibly loud thunder.
Mm.
And then the lightning hits. You could reach out and touch it. I was scared to death. So she said, I have a recording. I recorded some conversations with her. And she said, I got you in the bed and I held you and you were so scared. And I was too, but I didn't want you to know I was scared.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought that how lucky I was blessed. And I think about those kids on the border that are incarcerated, children. And everyone deserves a Grandma Murphy. I'm just so glad she was my grandmother. I have this immense love for Billy. Just thanks, Grandma.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.